we are coming this evening to a song that we'll study now, a psalm, actually. It is Psalm 120, and I encourage you to take your copy of the Bible and open up to that portion. This is the first of 15 special psalms that we're going to be studying together, and you can see from your bulletin that the title that I've given to this message is Out of Place and Far From Home. And once we get into the psalm in a little bit, you'll see why it is that I've titled it that. This is a day of dark memories for our country, isn't it? 9/11. Some of you remember very vividly where you were when you heard the news about the things that were happening, first in New York and then in D.C. and finally in Pennsylvania. I had relatives back in the D.C. area when this took place who were involved in the efforts afterwards to sort out what was happening. It took some time, but eventually we pieced together some things. We found out that the attacks were orchestrated by Al-Qaeda, and that Al-Qaeda was being hosted by the Taliban, and that the Taliban were the ruling people of Afghanistan. All of these bands and stands were a lot of folks that most of us didn't know very much about, but we came to find, most of us, to learn that the Taliban were an extremist group who were leading a part of the world that had long been known for its love of war. Now, I don't mean to stereotype and to say that Afghanis are by nature warsome or anything like that, but the history of that part of the world is one of constant wars, major armies coming in and out and passing through. And as a token of that, I want to show you something this evening. Now, as I reach for this, I want you to know, firstly, it's unloaded, and secondly, it's not functional. It's a decorative piece. This is a rifle that my father got back in the 1970s. It's called a Jazail. It's a handmade Afghan rifle. Back in the 70s, there was a gun club that went into Afghanistan, and they knew that these Jazails were being made by campfires and things, and so they started trading them for modern munitions. They would give them Russian shotguns in exchange, and then these were brought back to the States, and they would be sold. You can see that this has very old ball and musket munitions over here on this side, and all of this white that you see, that's mother of pearl. That was all inset by the wood, inlaid wood by hand. Hours and hours would be spent around campfires and places like that, decorating your armament. This is so long, it would have to be fired with a tripod. There were metal pieces that were attached at that end. And some of the people of Afghanistan were famous for their wars that they won with the Jazail. Guns in that part of the world, at least for a long time, were so prized that you weren't really considered a man if you didn't have a gun of some kind like this. There was woven into the culture a love for picking fights and beating your enemies. I mention that because the psalm we come to today mentions some peoples of far-off lands, far away to the psalmist, war-loving people. People who were giving trouble to the psalmist. The Bible has a lot to say about conflict and battles, and actually the battles that the psalmist is concerned about aren't really physical battles fought with real weapons. They're battles with the tongue. He has enemies who are acting like war-loving hate-mongers who are saying the worst, awfulest things about him, of which he is totally undeserving. And he brings it before God and begs for the Lord to bring him help. So at this time, let's read Psalm 120, and then I'll say some more introductory things before we move through the movements. Psalm 120, the heading tells us it is a song of ascents. In my trouble, I cried to the Lord, and he answered me. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given to you, and what more shall be done to you, you deceitful tongue? Sharp arrows of the warrior, with the burning coals of the broom tree. Woe is me, for I sojourn in Meshech, for I dwell among the tents of Kedar. Too long has my soul had its dwelling with those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. The psalmist feels out of place and very far from home. Now, before we consider this poem itself, I want to direct your attention to verse 0. That is the heading, that little title above verse 1. It's part of the Hebrew text. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, that's considered the beginning of verse 1. It's a heading that tells us this is a song of ascents. And will you do me the favor of just glancing at Psalm 121 and 122 and 123? Just look at above verse 1. You see it again and again. Psalm 121, a song of ascents. And then the next one, 122, a song of ascents of David. And 123, a song of ascents. 15 psalms in a row have this heading. Now, it's not explained to us what it is, but there are some very old understandings about what this is referring to. There are some different theories. Most of them, though, relate to the Israelites going to the sanctuary for worship. And the explanation that makes the most sense to me is that these were songs that came to be sung when the Israelites would go to Jerusalem for the great festivals. Three times a year, all the Hebrew men were required to go to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That would be around the end of April or early May. Then there was the Feast of First Fruits, or it came to be called the Feast of Pentecost, which would be the end of May, the beginning of June. And lastly, there was the Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles, or Ingathering. There are multiple names for it, June and July. Every able-bodied Hebrew man was expected to go unless he had some sort of exemption. And some people had a long way to go. They would have to walk for a few days, some of them from the far north, to get to Jerusalem. These songs seem to be tunes that were sung along the way. And what indicates that to us is not only the reference to ascending, that is, going up. Jerusalem, remember, sits on a hill. So even if you come from the north, by the time you get there, you've got to go up to get to the holy city. But also, throughout these psalms, there are references to gathering together in Jerusalem. This one doesn't mention it. This one has the idea that I'm far, far away from Jerusalem. But if you look at Psalm 122, look at that one, Psalm 122, verse 1. I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord. Our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. And then the verses following describe how wonderful it is to be in Jerusalem, even though it's all crowded with all of these pilgrims who are there. Quite a few of the other psalms speak about being there in Jerusalem and how good it is and how good the Lord's house is. And Psalm 133, how good and pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity. These seem to be pilgrim songs. And for that reason, I'm calling this series, As We Upward Go, Songs As We Upward Go. The restoration of worship at the tabernacle was one of David's greatest achievements. And he is the author of probably the earliest of the Songs of Ascent, as he was helping people to get in the mood for those great holidays together. Now this one, Psalm 120, which we turn our attention to more directly now, doesn't have any statement of authorship. We don't know who wrote it. It could be David, although it's odd that there's no reference. In fact, I suppose that it's not. It suggests, it hints in ways that whoever wrote this is someone not close to Jerusalem, who is far away and certainly feels far away because of the sort of people that are around him. He is surrounded by godless people who don't give a rip about God, who aren't interested in the worship of God. They're interested instead in tearing him down. This psalm that we just read breaks up into, I suppose, three movements. And I supplied you with a print handout tonight, and I'm not going to be using this as my sermon outline, but this is a study outline that shows you how the psalm starts off with a statement of confidence in verse 1, and it's followed by prayers in verses 2, 3, and 4, prayerful complaints that the Lord, for him to do something about these enemies. And then it ends in verses 5 and 7 with a painful lament. He's not even praying so much. He's just emoting and expressing the frustration that he has of having to deal with people who treat him so unfairly. So here's a thought that I believe we can hang all of our understanding of this psalm on tonight. If you're taking notes, here's one sentence. This is the sermon in a sentence, if you will. When we are wrongly attacked, we can come to God with confidence that He hears our cries and our sighs. When we feel wrongly attacked, we can be confident. We can come to God with confidence that He hears our cries and our sighs. So cries and sighs, and that's, if you're a spell fiend, that's S-I-G-H-S, that kind of sigh. The first four verses are about crying to God, and the last three verses are about sighing through our hardships. So let's go to the first four verses where we learn that we can be confident even as we cry out to God. Confident as we cry out to God. The first verse is an introduction where the psalmist remembers God's past deliverance. You look with me in verse 1. He says, "In my trouble I cried to the Lord, and He answered me." Now, if everything else was like that, we would say that this song was not a lament. We would say this is a song of thanks, because this is so positive. It's so uplifting. I'd been in great difficulty. I prayed. God answered and took me out of that difficulty. And implied here is I'm thankful for what the Lord has done. But I think what the psalmist is doing here, he's not talking about the circumstances in verses 2 through 7. He's looking back to some previous trouble that he had been in. He had seen God answer prayer and help him, and that gave him confidence that when he cried to God in this new situation, in this new perplexity, that the same God who helped him before would help him again. The difficulty, though, in this new situation, the situation, it's mentioned there in verse 2, that, deliver me from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. And he's not talking about his own lips or his own tongue. He's talking about people who are lying about him. As you get to the end of the psalm, you find out this has been going on for a long time. And it's wearing on him. He trusts God. He knows God hears him and sees him. But God seems slow in answering this request. "Too long has my soul suffered," he says. "Too long has my soul had its dwelling with those who hate peace," in the sixth verse. He's crying out here, although he's not out of hope. He remembers God's past deliverance in that first verse. And I'll tell you what, in our prayers, when we come into new troubles, deep waters, uncertainties, we've got to remember how God has helped us in the past. We need to rehearse the way the Lord has been there, the way the Lord has sovereignly turned things around. We forget so easily. We get into new troubles and we sometimes act like this is something God's never seen before. And we forget sometimes that these are things we've seen before and the Lord has seen us through them. It's good for us to rehearse the ways God's answered prayer. You know, one thing that some people find useful is to keep a prayer journal where you jot down the things that you're praying for. And not only that, but then you jot down how the Lord answers that prayer. And then periodically read through that. That's one way to help us be mindful about how the Lord is there to deliver us. We have a prayer hearing and a prayer answering God. And He invites us to cast our burdens upon Him. Recalling and recounting His goodness is so helpful to our faith. And that's why Paul, taps into this notion in Philippians 4:6 when he says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with," what is it? "With thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." And at least part of that thanksgiving is being thankful for how God has been there for you in the past. To know that He's not abandoned you and it's nothing new to Him. So he cries out now in that second verse for deliverance from new trouble. Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips. And again, he's not talking about himself. Dear God, I've got a problem with lying. Help me. Now, maybe some of us do have difficulty with the truth, and we need to be more consistent, and it's good to pray to God to make us more consistent. But he's not talking about his own lips. The remaining verses make clear he's talking about people who are lying about him. We're not told what the deception is about. I would guess, based on other things we read in the Psalms, that it's some kind of character assassination. They're accusing him of things that he hasn't done, claiming that he is some evil person, which he is not. Maybe the psalmist is a leader within the community. Maybe he's a Levite. We don't know. But whatever is happening to him, it is character assassination, and it wears on him. And he feels like there's only so much he can do. But he's remembered what God has done, and he confidently prays for deliverance here in the present. And then his prayer takes a different direction in verses 3 and 4. So if verse 1 is about remembering God's past deliverance, and verse 2 is about praying for God's present grace, verses 3 and 4 is about focusing on future vindication. Focusing on future vindication. The psalmist is tired, and maybe his patience is being stretched, but he's confident that there is coming a day when God will make things right. The language that the psalmist uses is very difficult and challenging here. In fact, it goes in an unexpected direction. In verse 3, he starts to speak to his enemies. It's sort of an aside within his prayer. Verse 4 continues the prayer, but verse 3, he's kind of imaginatively talking to his opponents. They're not actually listening to him. It's obvious when you get to the end of the psalm, they're not listening to him at all. But he wishes he could just sit down with them and help them to realize that God is going to hold them to an account for what they are doing. Look at that third verse with me. What shall be given to you? And what more shall be done to you, you deceitful tongue? Now that sounds like a strange question. It's not the sort of statement we would think of. He's not really speaking to the tongues of the people either. He's talking to the owners of those tongues. And what is probably not obvious to us as English speakers is that the words that the psalmist is using here, these are the words of oaths. This is the language of oath making. And what I mean by that is when people would make a vow, they would often place themselves under a curse. I declare to you that such and such is true, and if that is not true, may God do so to me and more also. May God, paraphrase would be, if what I'm saying isn't right, may God judge me. The way it's often expressed is, if this doesn't happen, then may such and such happen to me and more. So back here in verse 3, what shall be given or done to you, what more shall be done to you, the Hebrew expression is borrowed out of that language of making oaths. Let's read a couple of them. Keep your spot here in Psalm 120. Turn back to Ruth chapter 1. Ruth chapter 1. Now, if you're not sure where that is, if you go to Deuteronomy, that's too far back. Then flip forward, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and it's right before 1 Samuel. Ruth 1, verse 17, and here is the oath that Ruth is making to her mother-in-law about how committed she is to being with her. Ruth, remember, was not an Israelite. She was a Moabite, married to an Israelite boy. Israelite boy dies, and so mother-in-law says, well, you just go back home, and I'll go back to my home. And she says, no, I'm going to be with you. And verse 17, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do or give to me, and worse, literally, and more, if anything but death parts you and me. God, give me more judgment than you can imagine if I don't keep my word. This is an oath. Flip forward to 1 Samuel 3. 1 Samuel chapter 3. In this chapter, Samuel, the boy, has been hearing from God something that Eli, his tutor, had not heard apparently in many years. And Eli knows, he's been talking to him, and he insists that he tell him what God has said. Verse 17, he said, "What is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you. May God give to you, do to you, give to you judgment and more." This is the language of no, and I'm putting you under oath, Samuel, and if you lie, God is going to judge you. That's what's implied. Let's look at one more. 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 3. 2 Samuel 3 and verse 35. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was still day. But David vowed, saying, "May God do so to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down." Now, I'm serious, David says. I'm making an oath here. If I break my fast, then may God judge me, and judge me more than you think he could. May he give to me, may he do to me, and more. Back here in Psalm 120, that is the language of verse 3. What shall be done to you? And what more shall be done to you? The thought is, God is going to hold you to account, you liars. There is judgment to come, and it will be much more than you expect it to be. I wouldn't doubt that the enemies of the psalmist, when they lied about him and what he had done and what he had said and what he was, that they had made oaths. "Oh, I swear by Baal or by Yahweh or whatever that he is this and he said that and whatever," and they've perjured themselves. "May God do so more to me, and also if what I've said about this man isn't true." It's terrible. You know, the commandment about not taking the Lord's name in vain, there in the Ten Commandments. When Moses starts to expound on the law in the chapters that follow, the very first application of that law is not using the Lord's name when you make a false oath. To invoke the Lord, "Oh, the Lord is my witness," and then you lie. That's the number one violation of that commandment. And that's probably the kind of thing that the psalmist is dealing with. So he turns the tables on them. He, as it were, puts them under oath. God sees and hears what you're saying. You're not going to get away with this. He knows that in the end, God is the ultimate judge. God sees. God hears. You know, there's comfort in that. And while we don't delight in the judgment of the wicked, there is a beauty to God's justice. And so in verse 4, he describes in a poetic way what the more judgment is going to be, this what God is going to do. Verse 4, "Sharp arrows of the warrior with the burning coals of the broom tree." Now, this is also a cryptic verse, isn't it? He's not describing the liars here that their tongues are like arrows. There are verses that describe that, you know, your tongue can be like a weapon, and we all ought to be careful how we use our tongues. But the thought here is that God is going to send arrows to you. Sharp arrows. Sharp-tongued liars will eventually feel the sharp return of justice. And it's ironic because often words are likened even to arrows. Let me just read to you a couple places. Psalm 57, verse 4. "My soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire, the sons of men, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue is a sharp sword." Here's another one, Psalm 64, verses 2 to 4. The psalmist cries out, "Hide me from the secret counsel of evildoers, from the tumult of those who do iniquity, who have sharpened their tongue like a sword. They aimed bitter speech as their arrow to shoot from concealment at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear." They've been shooting at the psalmist here. But he tells them, the Lord is going to boomerang that on you. There are sharp arrows headed for you. They've actually picked a fight with God by going after God's man. Now, the end of the verse mentions something that is probably very cryptic to us. He says, "With burning coals of the broom tree." What is that? The broom tree is a kind of juniper. And the broom tree is renowned for having a hard wood that takes a really long time to burn. And so this wood would often be broken down into charcoal pieces. And it would burn and burn and burn and burn for a long time. This wood was so hard, it was often used to forge arrows, ironically. And it burned so long, it could even be used as an incendiary weapon that could be shot at enemies. So the arrows that are coming for them have got fire on them. And they're going to do their work. And again, the point here is not to rejoice in judgment, to give any kind of nanny-nanny boo-boo kind of sort of thing. It's not gloating like this, but there is a beauty in knowing that our God will deal with sin. He deals with all sin. He either deals with it by mercy and forgiveness through the blood of His Son, or He deals with it through righteous wrath. And there is coming a day in which all will give an account, either through Christ or on their own merits. And then, you know, there's no room for us to gloat. Were it not for the grace of God, we would be the recipients of these kind of everlasting arrows. The gospel has taught us how we have been spared what we deserve. But note here how the psalmist, he doesn't wage war against these people. He doesn't do a tit for tat. He doesn't start a smear campaign against them and say, well, they deserve it and they don't deserve any mercy or any fairness. He leaves vindication in God's hands. We don't know when or how God will make all things right. We know that at the very end He will. There is a sort of an end-time justice that we hold on to, a confidence that our God is going to make all wrongs right. In the end, He will do it. Before then, sometimes He does it too, and it's glorious to see how God turns things around. You can see it in the lives of people in the Bible, as Pastor Ed had taught us through the book of Daniel, how God vindicated Daniel and his friends and vindicated Daniel time and time again. We have a God who's able to turn things around. So these first four verses are about being confident when we cry out. Confident when we cry out. Let's go to the last few verses. This is the part of the psalm that sounds like a sigh, a moan. It's not even expressed as a prayer so much as the psalmist is speaking to his fellow Israelite. These verses teach us that we can be spiritual even when we sigh about our plight. So the first half is we can be confident as we cry to our God, as we cry out about our problems. In this part, we can be spiritual even as we sigh about our plight. That sense of frustration, of things aren't right, and how long is this going to go, that's not necessarily an unspiritual feeling. Now, a couple weeks ago, and I want to be careful here, I don't want to undo good, but a couple weeks ago we had a Singspiration, we sang songs by Fanny Crosby. Fanny Crosby's had her critics. And some of the criticisms against her, I think, are overstated. But one criticism that probably has a little bit of merit is that she tends to write about the Christian life in a romantic way. It's singing as we go, and life is always happy and joyful. And she does write about hardship, but there's this almost a romantic view of the Christian life that if you put the right spin on it, it's always happy. You know, there's another song, not by her, but kind of at the same generation, that says, "And now I am happy all the day." Well, I'm not happy all the day. That doesn't mean that I don't have joy, but, you know, we're not called to be, you know, happy-go-lucky all the time, right? The example we find in these verses is that there's a place for wishing things to be different without being discontent, without being sinfully self-absorbed. Now, it is possible to become discontent and sinfully impatient, but what the psalmist does here is model for us this yearning for things to be made right. You know, it's not wrong to be grieved over falsehood. In the Gospel of Mark in particular, we hear a time or two how Jesus was grieved. It even says that he sighed within himself, frustrated with his clueless disciples, that they weren't getting it. The hard-heartedness of the Pharisees and the dim-wittedness of his disciples and the plight of the people, these are things that fatigued Jesus. It's not unspiritual to react with a sigh. So look with me in verses 5 and 6, and notice here how the psalmist is sighing for righteous company. He's sighing for righteous company. He has grown weary of ungodly, pagan-like neighbors around him, and he wants to be around people who know and love the Lord. He says in verse 5, "Woe is me, for I sojourn in Meshech, for I dwell among the tents of Kedar." Now, this is another cryptic verse, isn't it? We had broom trees and arrows and doing more in the previous verses, and now here's these two places. The language here, you need to know right away that this is poetic language. The psalmist is not literally in Meshech. He is not literally in Kedar. He could not be in both places at once because they are far apart from each other. Meshech is up in northern Turkey, perhaps even part of the Caucasus region, bordering between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. The people of Meshech were known for a long time as being a war-loving people. That region was settled by Noah's grandson, the sixth son of Jephthah, back in Genesis 10, verse 2. In the records of Assyria, they're called the Muski. There may or may not be a connection later on with Moscow to the north, but in the days of the Bible, that was not where Meshech was. They were known for their metallurgy technology, for crafting weapons out of bronze. They were involved with a slave trade of Tyre. They were in league with the people of Tubal, and they were sworn enemies of a lot of people. They are described in Ezekiel 32 as a warlike people. So when he says this here, "I sojourn in Meshech," he's not gone on a long trip. He's saying that the people around me are like these war-loving people. Some of the worst barbarian-type people you can think of, that's who I've got living next to me. And then he mentions another warlike people at the end of verse 5, the tents of Kedar. This is a tribe of predatory roaming people who lived in northwest Arabia. So this would be to the southeast of Israel, but within the Arabian Peninsula would be in the northwestern portion. The people of Kedar were the descendants of Ishmael, Genesis 25. Mostly involved in shepherding and trading, but because water was so unpredictable and is so unpredictable in that part of the world, they were nomads and lived in tents and often made raids on cities to get stuff that they wanted. And because of their power and their willingness to live where no one else wanted to live, they dominated the trade routes that ran through Arabia. And in the days of Isaiah, they actually had a fairly significant kingdom stretched out across the Arabian Peninsula. Isaiah 21 talks about how warlike these people were. Let me read for you Isaiah 21, 16 and 17. "Thus says the Lord, thus the Lord said to me, in a year as a hired man would count it, all the splendor of Kedar will terminate. And all the remainder of the bowmen, the mighty men of the sons of Kedar, will be few, for the Lord God of Israel has spoken. Meaning that in Isaiah's day, they were a feared people. The king of Israel was worried about them, but God was going to bring them to an end. So here are two far-flung places where I think the psalmist is not actually living. He is probably describing fellow Israelites as being warlike pagans. I feel like I live around Meshkevites. I feel like I live beside Kedarites. Some of these people, they just want to fight. They want to take. They don't care about God. They don't care about me. They just want. They might be sons of Abraham by birth. The people of Kedar, you know, were related to Abraham. But in their lifestyle, they were like war-loving pagans. And you feel, as the psalmist says this, that he wants to be around different people. Do you ever feel like that? Now, we're thankful we have the church, but we're not together 24/7, 7 days a week. We're here together a few hours a week. And sometimes we rub shoulders with people we work with, or we live nearby, or we even have relatives. We may not enjoy them all that much because they're just given over to sin and self, and they put the screws on you. And you wonder sometimes, Lord, how long? Look with me in, verse 6, he continues his thoughts about this. Too long has my soul had its dwelling with those who hate peace. He's just tired of being around them and always wanting to pick a fight. It is tiring living in this world. We live in a world that loves conflict. A lot of social media, not all of it, but a lot of social media is motivated by conflict. And sometimes we're stuck in the crossfire, and sometimes we have things aimed right at us. In verse 7, we see the psalmist sighing for peaceful resolution. He was sighing earlier for righteous company, and here in verse 7, he's sighing for peaceful resolution. I am for peace. But when I speak, they are for war. I don't want to be fighting them all the time. I don't want to have to be dealing with this all the time. I would like to be at peace with them. I've not done anything to deserve the things they're saying about me and these accusations. I'm not the cause of all of this. I'm for peace. I've sought peaceful resolution. I've not done anything to deserve this. The kind of war that they want is a personal war, not a national war. Lying, you know, is a kind of warfare. Lying about others and putting others, destroying others with their tongues. Christians ought to be peace-loving people who seek resolution, who seek peace and pursue it. And unfortunately, many times our Christian relationships aren't known for that. Sometimes Christian marriages aren't known for that. And you end up in a spot sometimes where one person wants peace and the other one just wants war. It's tragic. But hearts that have been discipled by grace and know what the Lord can do and how the Lord can change things gives an optimism when you have a Christian brother or a Christian sister that peace can flourish. Here, I believe the psalmist is dealing mostly with unsaved people. And he cries to God for help. And he sighs, waiting, wishing, longing for things to be different. This is a pilgrim psalm. You know, the places that are mentioned in this psalm are way, way far away from Jerusalem. As you keep reading the psalms that follow, we get closer and closer to Jerusalem. In fact, the very next one, he talks about how, where do I lift up my eyes? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. And the Lord is with me. He's going to help me. And then in Psalm 122, if you're reading straight through, there you are in Jerusalem with God's people, with good people who love peace and pursue it. But we can't always be together. We have to be out in the world, and it's hard. So when we're wrongly attacked, know that you can come to God with confidence that He hears your cries and He hears your sighs. And so as we walk and live, may we live by the grace that's delivered us and in confidence and the grace that's yet to be revealed. Father, we thank you for this psalm. It's full of some complexities, some things that are foreign to us, and yet it speaks powerfully. We can identify to one degree or another with the frustration of living in a lie-loving world. We know the pain of falsehood that spread and said about us. As we leave this place tonight and go to our neighborhoods and our workplaces and interact with people who are in very different places on the spiritual map, may we remember that you, our God, are with us. Even when we feel out of place and far from home, you are there. You, the one who deliver us, you see and you hear, and you will bring about the perfect peace that you've promised through your Son. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.